This migration was the greatest underreported story of the 20th century. How could it have been missed? 6 million African Americans, 6 million African Americans left the Jim Crow South, the caste system under which they were bound for all points north and west. Again, they started in World War I, and it did not end until the reasons for their departure finally began to disappear as Jim Crow was dismantled. There are so many things that are inspiring about this migration that gave me heart and kept me going for 15 years. That is a really long time. It's sobering to think how huge this migration was and how little we really know about it. We know it existed, but it is so much a part of the fabric of America that we often take it for granted. And it was my goal to try to restore it to its rightful place in history. Think about this. The majority of African Americans that you will ever meet in the North, Midwest, and West are descended from the Great Migration. That means they are direct descendants and beneficiaries, and were in some ways the purpose and reason for the goals and dreams of the people who made this great trek all across the country. It was really for these children and grandchildren and now great-grandchildren, so that their lives would be better. I wrote this book for many different reasons, but first of all, probably for personal reasons. I myself, like the others that I've told you about, grew up as the daughter of the Great Migration. No one ever called it that. No one, I think probably for any of us who were children and descended from this, ever heard the word Great Migration growing up, really. It was just understood to be a fact of life. My mother migrated from Rome, Georgia, to Washington, D.C. toward the end of World War II. And my father came in the 1950s from Petersburg, Virginia, after he'd been a Tuskegee Airman. Had they not participated in the Great Migration, had they not left their respective states and different cities or towns in the South, I would not be here. And so the majority of African Americans in the North and West owe their very existence, not to mention whatever successes or opportunities they had as a result of being able to grow up outside of the South, a South that was very different then than it is now. We owe our very existence to the people who made this great trek, which is so very American. How many Americans owe their very existence to the fact that a great-grandmother from Ireland happened to have met some great-grandfather from Italy and ended up here within the shores of the United States, perhaps in New York, perhaps in Boston, perhaps in Chicago, and now an entire lineage, new families were formed as a result of someone making the decision to leave the only place they had ever known for a place they had never seen in hopes that life would be better. It is a classic American story, and the people who were part of the Great Migration left for the same reasons that anyone ever crossed the Atlantic in steerage, crossed the Pacific Ocean or the Rio Grande in hopes of something better. But this migration was different because the people who were part of it were leaving a part of their own country and were leaving for another part, another region within the borders of their own land. That makes it very, very different. More tragic and poignant than in some ways because they should not have had to have done what they did, but they did. This migration then, it ended up being as much a defection from the Jim Crow South as it was a migration. In some ways, it was a seeking of political asylum. One of the goals of this book, which I hope comes through in the beautiful narratives of these amazing people that I had the opportunity to spend time with, is that they were part of a system, under a system that they wanted to escape and be free from. And they made the decision, the brave decision, to leave. I began the book with a great sense of urgency. And that was because the migration began in 1915 and it ended in the 1970s, which meant that there were multiple generations of people who were part of this. And that meant that the people were getting up in years, time was running out, and I wanted to be able to tell the story before it was too late. I want to give a sense of what it was like to be growing up in the Jim Crow South. What was it like for the three people that I've mainly spent most of the time writing about and the others who are referred to in this book? What was it like? A lot of us think we know because we hear about the water fountains and the restrooms. There are no references to that in this book. I set out on a course to be able to describe as closely as I could what were they truly leaving? Why did they leave? What was this caste system that had been created, this insanity under which they were living? I wanted to recreate it. I wanted every one of us to think about what would we have done, regardless of your own ethnicity or background, what would you have done if you were under the circumstances that the people that I've described, that I've spent so much time looking at, what would you have done if you were living in those circumstances? Would you have left? Would you have stayed? Would you have borne up under this or would you have not? Would you have buckled under the system and done what you were told, or would you have chafed under the system that was really untenable and was not sustainable, ultimately? Not sustainable because it required violence to enforce it. During the beginning of the Great Migration, there was a lynching somewhere in the South, one lynching every 3 days. That means violence was all around them. This book is not about the violence. That was a factor and a feature of their lives. They could not ever really escape the idea that at any moment something could happen to someone that they loved. So let me give you a little sense of what it was like, give you some examples of some of the laws that they lived under. It was against the law for a black person and a white person to play checkers together. Against the law. Now you think, why would someone sit down, or how would someone sit down and actually write this out as a law? Someone must have seen a black person and a white person sitting together on a park bench, playing checkers and having just too good of a time and saying, we can't have this. And they sat down and wrote that as a law. There were actually separate windows for people to buy their stamps at a post office. There were separate windows for people to make their deposits at a bank. And there were, in many courthouses throughout the South, there was a black Bible and a white Bible to swear to tell the truth on. Now, all of these things sound so completely absurd, but this was not something that was being hidden. I actually became almost obsessed with finding how the most arcane examples of how people were forced to be divided, because it became almost this opportunity to describe in so many ways, in little ways, ways that you wouldn't have expected, that someone actually sat down to try to figure out how to keep people apart. How could there possibly be the opportunity to bond and get to know one another when every aspect of your life was being conscribed this way and limited in the ways that other people would not have even imagined? You know, we live with the effects of this to this day, is that for many generations, there was a caste system that held everyone in a fixed place. You think about a caste. Caste, C-A-S-T-E, was the system that I'm speaking about, but also the physical caste that is used to hold in place a bone that needs to be repaired, or to hold in place something else, a caste that if you're a sculptor. And what that does is it keeps you bound and fixed in a particular position so that you cannot move. And that meant that everyone was hurt by this. It wasn't just African Americans in the South who were hurt by it, obviously, and there's no question about that. But it also hurt the people who were holding the caste together. They too were limited from being able to grow and to be able to be their fuller selves. And think about this. It meant that they didn't have the opportunity to get to know perhaps wonderful, wonderful people. What a gift it was for me to be able to spend so much time with the amazing people that I had the chance to know in working on this book. I can't imagine life without having met these people. I have such great affection and love for the people that I wrote about, and I hope it comes through in the book. Now, these people were not perfect, and they didn't present themselves as being perfect, and I love them for that too. But this is the thing. It meant that people who might have been the best of friends back in the Jim Crow South, and to the extent that it also spread to other parts of the United States, it meant that people who might have been the best of friends in other circumstances did not even get a chance to know one another because of a caste system that kept everyone fixed in their place. And my mother has told me the story of how when her grandmother was trying to raise money to send her daughters to college, she would take in laundry from wealthy white women in town in Rome, Georgia, where my mother grew up. And she said my mother said there was this one woman in particular, a white woman in particular, who my grandmother got along with famously. They got along so well. They must have had similar personalities. They laughed at the same things, seemed to view the world the same way, and would have just a really good time when the woman would drop off the clothes. But my mother said that in another time and place, they would very likely have been the very best of friends, but it was not meant to be in the Jim Crow South. Both women knew, my grandmother and this woman who would come to visit her, that it stayed within the confines of that living room, my grandmother's living room, and that when they left that space, then things had to return to the way the caste system dictated that it be. So there were losers on all sides of it, and I would hope that people would recognize that, and would take the opportunity to recognize that we don't have to live like that anymore. What a blessing and a gift that we don't have to do this anymore. And in part, it's because of the fact that we now have this huge dispersal of African Americans all over the country and of other groups of people all over the country. We don't have to live like that anymore. Let me talk a little bit about the significance of this great migration. From the moment I started writing this book, 15 years, people began to say, well, we've heard of it, but why are you writing about this? You know, I got so many questions about that. They didn't quite understand what was pulling me to write this. I felt compelled to write this book. I had no choice but to write this book. I could not rest until I wrote this book. The book had to be written. Not writing it was not an option. The problem was that once I was like into the seventh and eighth year, I began to wonder how I was going to finish the book. But not finishing it wasn't going to be an option. I had gone too far to not continue it to the end. Let me give you a sense of the significance of this great migration. At the beginning of the 20th century, before the great migration began, 90% of all African Americans were living in the South. By the end of the great migration, 1970s, nearly half of all African Americans were living outside of the South. They were living in that great arc from Washington, D.C. to Philadelphia to New York, Boston, over to Cleveland, Chicago, Detroit, and then all the way over to the West Coast here, Seattle, Oakland, San Francisco, Los Angeles, San Diego. They were living everywhere but the South. And that was a huge dispersal of people, an entire relocation of an entire people throughout the entire United States. It was not a haphazard unfurling of lost souls at all. The people went to places that were almost as predictable as the fact that if you would go to Minnesota, you would run into so many people who were from Sweden and Norway. Or if you went to the Lower East Side of New York, you would run into people who were from Italy. Or if you went to South Boston, you would run into people from Ireland. They were orderly. There was an orderly transfer of human beings along three main routes that exist in the backgrounds and genealogy of almost every African American you might meet. You can almost tell where a person's family or people are from based on where they happen to be living right now. For example, if you're in Chicago, very likely your people are from Mississippi or Arkansas. It was just that orderly. They were following the railroad lines and the bus routes, and they were following the places where one or two people or a small core of people from their small town happened to have gone. One thing about Oakland, I'm getting ahead of myself, but I want to say it because we are in Oakland, is that Oakland was the great terminus, the receiving station for people from particular parts of Louisiana, and particularly from a place called Monroe, Louisiana. And I'm going to get to that a little bit later, but Monroe, Louisiana was the hometown of one of the three people that I write about, the three protagonists in this book. And I cannot wait to read to you something about him. But I want to at least preface any discussion of that with the idea of, let me give you a sense of what they were up against when they tried to leave. It was not easy to leave. It was not easy to leave on multiple levels. First of all, it's difficult to leave. Just moving is hard. Anybody moving is hard. Moving is just a difficult thing to do. But these people were not relocating for a new job in the same way that we might do it now. These people were leaving the only place they'd ever known, family, parents, siblings, the land that their forefathers had worked for free when they were during slavery. They were leaving the only place, they were leaving the culture, the folkways, the music, the food, all of those things that were familiar to them. Never again would they be able to, given the fact that we didn't have cell phones and Skype in those days, never would they be able to take for granted the idea that they could just sit down for a cup of coffee with their grandmother. Those days would be over by their very leaving. And they knew that as they were going, because it was a different time and place. Not only was it difficult emotionally and spiritually, but it was physically difficult to leave. The South was not giving up its cheap labor easily. And they set up many, many barriers to keep people from leaving. One of the things that they did, particularly in the earlier decades of the Great Migration, is that when they saw large numbers of African Americans standing at the railroad platforms with tickets ready to board a train, they would begin arresting people wholesale. They would arrest them on charges of peonage, that peonage meaning that you need to be working, and you're not working right now. Or on charges that they owed the planter that they might have worked for, some debt, real or imagined, that they needed to account for. And so it made there were all kinds of barriers that were erected to keep them from being able to leave. Sometimes when there would be large numbers of black people on a train, they would then arrest them from the train itself. And when those things didn't work, when they happened not to be able to do that, they would a train might be coming through a particular town, and if they saw many African Americans on the platform, they would wave the train on through so that the people couldn't board. People learned to find other ways to get out. It was in some ways like the Underground Railroad, only I call it the Overground Railroad. They would find other ways to get out. They would go to another town where there might not be as many black people leaving, so where they wouldn't attract as much attention. They would leave in the middle of the night, begin to pack up their things quietly and not tell people that they were leaving. They kept things to themselves because they couldn't even know who they could trust. Even the people that were around them, they could. The people on the same plantation or the small town where they lived, they might not be able to trust them because there were all kinds of spies working even there. It's hard to believe. It almost sounds like another country, and in many ways it was. They also made it difficult for people in the North to recruit anyone they might want to hire, any African American that they wanted to hire. They actually set up a fee of $25,000 for any Northerner who wanted to recruit in the state of Georgia. $25,000, that would be unbelievable now, and it would be astronomical back in 1918. And if you were caught without having this licensing fee in recruiting, you would face 1 year's hard labor or worse, which is something you would not want to experience in Georgia or Mississippi in 1918, I can assure you. So let me tell you about what I decided to do to try to tell this story. What I decided was I wanted it to be something that any reader could pick up and try to imagine themselves as these people. I wanted to find protagonists, that real people who had experienced what it was like to live through Jim Crow, were willing and at a point in their lives to talk about it freely, wanting to talk about it, and who would be open and authentic in their telling of their stories. I also needed to have three people who would represent the three major streams of the Great Migration. And the first stream is the one that carried my family, essentially what is the reason why I exist, which is the East Coast stream, which was from Florida, Georgia, the Carolinas, and Virginia, up to Washington, Philadelphia, New York, Boston. The second stream was from Mississippi and Arkansas to and parts of Alabama to Chicago, Detroit, Cleveland, the Great Midwest. And finally, the one that matters most to us tonight is the one that was the least written of all, and that's the one from Louisiana and Texas out to all points along the West Coast, San Diego, Los Angeles, San Francisco, Oakland, and Seattle. It's said that people who really wanted to get away were going to Seattle, because that was about as far as you could possibly get. You couldn't go any further than that. You'd be in the Pacific Ocean. So where did I go to find these three people? I should also say that I needed to find three people who also represented the three different decades. Each of these people left during three different decades. So it gives you a sense of the scope of this thing. It was not 1 year, one war, one decade. It went on for almost 60 years. Three generations has happened. People continued to leave. And at each juncture of this migration, after World War I, people thought, maybe some people hoping that it would be over. They would say, well, it's done now. The World War I is over. We don't need the people as much now. But it didn't end. Once the door was open, the people flooded through those doors. And no one told them that it was over. They thought it was over after the Depression. The people kept coming. World War II, certainly it's over by now. The people kept coming. In fact, more people came with each succeeding decade than had come in the original first parts of the migration. And so it continued on. Where did I find these three people? I stopped counting after 1,200. I interviewed over 1,200 people to settle on three. I could not write about all 1,200. I tried to list many of the major people that I talked to in the back of the book because I wanted to give them their due and to thank them, to express gratitude for their having taken the time to talk with me. I went to Detroit. I went to Milwaukee. I went to Chicago. I went to New York. I went to Los Angeles. And yes, I came here to Oakland. I went all over trying to find people who had migrated from during the years that we've described. And I went to senior centers, I went to AARP meetings, I went to quilting clubs, Baptist churches, Catholic mass, I went to Prince Hall Mason meetings, I actually had a booth at the Juneteenth parade in Los Angeles near Leimert Park. You all know what Juneteenth is? And I went to the Southern State clubs. How amazing is it that they're actually survived to the recent times, clubs that represent not just a southern state, but a town in a southern state, in the new world, as you might call it. There was the Lake Charles, Louisiana club. There was the Monroe, Louisiana club. There were multiple and many Texas clubs in Los Angeles. There were, and other parts of California. There were multiple New Orleans clubs. There were Creole clubs. There were clubs where people did Zydeco and clubs where people celebrated Mardi Gras. There were all kinds of things that were going on even to this day. In Chicago, there is a Greenwood, Mississippi club, a Greenville, Mississippi club, Newton, Mississippi club, Brookhaven, Mississippi club, and don't dare get them confused. Don't go to one thinking you're at the other because they have distinctive communities and folkways and cultures and people that they know from back home. It was a way of preserving the South in the North. And they had ways of doing that. This whole process meant that I had to have a lot of experiences. I went on multiple trips to Las Vegas with, for example, the Lake Charles, Louisiana Club, multiple trips to Las Vegas with them. And each of these places, people brought the food that was important to them. They actually recreated parts of the South here, in the West and in the North. I recall having seen a collard tree. You know collard greens? A collard tree here in Oakland. And I couldn't believe, I mean, apparently because it doesn't really freeze, per se, they never cut it down, so it turned into a tree. I thought that was beautiful. You know, just another way of maintaining the culture. I also went on multiple trips with in Chicago with people who were going to the riverboat casinos in Chicago. And I mention this because I was exposed to kinds of food that I was not accustomed to, because one of the things that is not known is that each of these migration streams carry different kinds of culture with them. It's not the same. It's not all one South and not all one North here. People brought specific things with them, and if you were to be from one stream and enter another stream or try to enter another stream, you could quickly be identified as an outsider. I had to earn my way into these clubs. I couldn't just walk up to a club and say, I'm writing a book about such and such and let me in. In fact, with the Monroe, Louisiana club, I had to get permission. I had to be vetted. I mean, you know, Pulitzer Prize didn't help at all with that. I mean, they said, you know, well, who is she? Who are her people? You know, my people were from Georgia, so it didn't help me at all. But with the group that was going to the riverboat casinos in Chicago, I thought that I was blending in fairly well until someone broke open a delicacy that had arrived fresh from Mississippi, which meant it was the really good stuff. And I'd never seen it before and I'd never heard of it before. I'd never tasted it, my mother never talked about it. It was not eaten apparently in Georgia. and it was Hoghead Cheese. How many of you have heard of that? I had never heard of it. I didn't know what it was. I had no idea. I had no idea. And they broke it open as if it were caviar. I mean, it was, and they cut it up just so carefully, and people in the back said, you know, be sure to save me some. You know, I didn't get enough, and give me some. It was amazing to see that happen. And where I, you know, when I came to California, I had never had oxtails. Never. I'd never had that. But then people here may not have had scrapple. So see, there's a difference. Food is a big deal in culture, and that was one of the small little side issues. I must tell you about one of the issues that I ran into. It's such a funny story about the process of trying to find people for this book. It was such an arduous, long process. It took me over a year and a half of going to place after place after place, senior center after senior center after senior center. I've been on the web for quite a while I actually made the papers here in Oakland because I had gone to Oakland Senior Center. It said Pulitzer Prize winner visits Oakland Senior Center. If you go on the web, you can see the story probably still even now. I mean, it's been over 10 years and I remained indelibly etched, I think, here. That was the only place that actually put me on the web, and I'm honored. Thank you for having visited. But when I was in Los Angeles, I went to one senior center, and what I would usually do is I would go in and I would tell them what I was doing, and I would say that if you moved from Louisiana or Texas between these years, you were part of the Great Migration, and I would like to talk with you for a book that I'm doing about the Great Migration. And usually people were, you know, kind of quizzical, like, you know, well, I came in 1947, does that mean that I was part of the Great Migration? And I'd say, yeah, really? No one ever used the term. But I went to one particular place. You had to make arrangements and let them know you were coming ahead of time. There were particular days that were really good on a Friday, if there was a fish fry, or on a day when there might have been beef on the menu, you'd have a really good turnout. Bingo was really a good turnout too. But in any case, whatever it was, at this particular senior center, there was a really good turnout. And they had a sort of formal presentation of people who were on the schedule and the agenda for this particular day. And so just ahead of me was someone from the Los Angeles County Department of Aging. And he handed out these pamphlets, and in the pamphlets, he passed them around. He said, please read these pamphlets carefully. We are getting reports of our seniors being taken advantage of. There are people who are going around to our seniors asking all kinds of questions, asking, where are you from? How many children do you have? What do you do for a living? Or what did you do for a living before you were retired? Asking questions about your home. What kinds of things do you like to do for recreation? All kinds of questions. And then they're using that to scam our seniors. So we want you to please read this brochure carefully and be careful about what you tell anyone who asks you any personal questions. Next up, Isabel Wilkerson will be speaking to us. And so I then had to, how do you recover from that? I mean, I had to just be very honest and truthful about what my purpose was. And I told them I was writing about the Great Migration, about the basically people who had come from the South and had populated the cities of the great cities of the West. And the people talked with me anyway. They must have been able to see that I, as a child of the Great Migration, had a great love and a passion and an insistence on finishing this thing no matter what, and they responded. So let me tell you about the three. One was Ida Mae Gladney, who was a sharecropper's wife who was terrible at picking cotton. I love that. You know, we just assume that it's an easy thing to do. Let me tell you. I'll tell you a little bit about how difficult it is to pick cotton. In order to pick cotton, the goal is to pick 100 pounds. 100 pounds of cotton requires that you pick 7,000 bowls of cotton, 7,000 little cotton balls in order to get 100 pounds. How much does a cotton ball weigh? That's the reason why you need that many. That is a lot of picking, and that would need to be done in one day. That's like 7,000 feathers. that you must amass in order to fulfill the responsibilities if you are a sharecropper or if you were a day picker for 50 cents, 75 cents a day. That was the magic number you were going for. She could never get 100. That is a lot of work in the beating sun. And I think that we take for granted how it's just work that they're doing, but that was hard, backbreaking labor. Anyway, she was not good at it and she didn't like it. She could kill a snake, but she could not pick cotton. She could wring a chicken's neck and make it for dinner, but she could not pick cotton. And she could plow, but she couldn't pick cotton, so she was not good at that. But that wasn't why they left. They left because a cousin of theirs was beaten to within an inch of his life and for something that he'd accused of doing but had not committed. And afterward, her husband came home and said, "This is the last crop we're making." And they left Chicago en route north, initially to Milwaukee, and they ultimately settled in Chicago. The second person was George Starling, who had gone to college, but the money had run out. There were no other places in his immediate environment, immediate vicinity, where he could have gone to college while as an African American in Florida. The only place that he could go was far away, and so he had to drop out, and he had to return to the work of the predominant industry in his part of Florida, which was citrus picking. He was too smart to be doing it, and he could see that they were being mistreated, taken advantage of, and underpaid for dangerous work. In order to do the work, they had to splice together ladders to go into 30 and 40 foot trees. People would often fall from the trees, break a limb. There was no workers' compensation. That was just the way things were. It was during World War II when there was a great demand for citrus, and he noticed that he could read the papers and see that these boxes that they were picking were going for $4 or so a box on the open market, and they were being paid 12 and 13 cents. He thought that perhaps for all that they were going through, they might be able to get a nickel more. And so we began organizing the pickers and saying, let's not pick today unless they give us a nickel more. His doing that put him in grave danger, and he had to flee for his life, and he went to Harlem. And then finally, Robert Joseph Pershing Foster. He was a surgeon who grew up in Monroe, Louisiana, one of the originating towns in the South that fed Oakland and also Los Angeles. He was a captain in the Army where he could perform surgery for the U.S. Army, but when he got out of the Army, it turned out he could not perform a simple tonsillectomy in his own hometown. He could not so much as walk into St. Francis Hospital in Monroe, Louisiana, and he set out for a course across the country to head to California, place of his dreams. He had never seen California before. He just knew in his bones that he wanted to be here. He was born for California, and he was determined to be here. He set out on a treacherous journey that was that disheartened him beyond belief, because he had underestimated how far Jim Crow extended. Many of you probably heard about the Green Books. How many have heard about them? They've gotten a lot of attention. The Green Books were guidebooks that were created specifically for African Americans during the era of Jim Crow. Because when they traveled, travel was hazardous on many levels. They could never be assured of finding a place to sleep, to rest. They could never be assured of being able to find a place to eat. They could not be assured that they would be waited on in a gas station if they needed gas or if their radiator overheated. And so they had to prepare and plan and pack as if they were leaving the country, which in some ways they were. They had to plan for every eventuality. They had to make sure there was enough ice and water in case the radiator overheated. They needed to make sure there was enough food for their children and for themselves that would maybe last the duration of the trip. And they often carried the Bible and would read from the Psalms to make sure that they could have a safe passage, particularly when it came to getting out here to the West, which was so perilous to begin with when you think about the roads before the interstates and how they had to take the two-lane roads through the mountains. And so he had underestimated how far this would have been. The Green Books The green books were guides that allowed, that would give an indication for people where they might be able to stop if they happen to be in Nashville, or they happen to be in Omaha, or if they happen to be in Birmingham. And generally these books were out of date. They were like AAA books, but they were out of date by the time they were printed. A lot of times these were not hotels at all. I mean, they were not motels even. They were sometimes a bed in a room in somebody's tenement. And so many people had the opportunity or took the opportunity to take advantage of what ultimately was a monopoly. And so these guidebooks were often reliable only to the degree that the people were still even there. If they happened to be in Memphis and they were going to an address in Memphis, there was no assurance that the people whose name was in the guidebook were even still in this particular apartment. So it was perilous to begin with. He had planned this trip out very well. And he had anticipated that by the time he got out of the state of Texas, all would be well. But that was not the case. I talked with him for so many hours about this trip, many, 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 many times about this. He said to me, this thing I've gone over 3,000 times. It so seared his memory and hurt him so. And he gave me an exquisite detail, every bend, every town, every place that he went along the route, and where he had the worst trouble of all. And I set out to recreate that journey, and I had my parents with me on this. My parents were retired by then. They, too, had migrated. They were always up for an adventure anyway, so the two of them got in the car. It was a Buick, as he had. He had a Buick Roadmaster, which he said drove like a chariot. And he said, if you had seen it, you would have wanted it, too. So I rented a Buick, and we set out on a journey from Louisiana to California, following his instructions as to what he had done. And we got to the mean, hard, ugly part of the drive. It's just anybody who takes a drive, if you're driving at night, it's just haunting. There, even to this day, are long stretches of 50, 80 miles where there are no settlements in certain parts of the West. The West, you know, each state in the West could be its own country. They're so big. Texas clearly could be a country unto itself, maybe a continent. And so it was, driving through the desert, even with my parents, was a difficult thing to experience. I did this because I wanted to experience what it was like to have the fingers almost lock themselves around the wheel because you've been clutching it for so long. The way that they begin to swell and ache from being in one position for so long. I wanted to experience what happens to where the eyelids grow so heavy that they begin to ache as well, and where you are fighting sleep. Every cell in your body wants to sleep, and yet you can't because here is another hairpin curve that you didn't see because it's pitch black. And that is what I wanted to experience. I told my parents up front, and my father could do but to take the wheel from me. But I told him up front, I have to do it because Dr. Foster had taken the entire route himself. He didn't have anybody in the car with him. He had to experience this on his own, and I wanted to try to recreate that to the best of my ability. By the time we got toward past the middle of Arizona, I began to feel the full weight of what it meant to go this long without rest and to be in the middle of the desert at night on winding two-lane roads, because they still are. I mean, they're going around the curve of a mountain, and so it's still two-lane even to this day. And we were during a really hard part of the journey, and my mother said, you know, he must have been about ready to cry in here, because she was ready to cry. And at a certain point, my parents said, as I was veering from the road, and at least we had guardrails, he didn't have guardrails, but at least we had them, but my parents didn't want to test that. So they said, you must stop. For all of our sakes, you must stop. And I didn't want to stop. And they said, well, if you don't want to stop, let us out. Because, you know, we don't want to go any further. And so we stopped in Yuma, Arizona. I felt that I had failed him because I had not carried out what he had been forced to do. He didn't have the choice. We had the choice. We stopped in Yuma, Arizona, with no trouble. There, we had our choice of places to stay. It was no longer 1953. And it shows you just how far we have come as a country, how very far we've come as a country. I want to read you a little bit about Dr. Foster. He was one of the most extraordinary people I've ever had the opportunity to meet. All three of them were amazing and beautiful and inspiring people. They were wise people, and they were at a point in their lives where they were willing to entrust their stories with me. They saw something in me, and I saw something in them, and there was a connection and a bond that I think suffuses the book, and I think that's the reason why people are drawn to the book. I really do. So I want to read you a little bit. This is from when I first met Dr. Robert Joseph Pershing Foster. It was Los Angeles, 1996. The panel door rises a story high and would befit a museum or government office, but is actually the front door of a Spanish revival south of Wilshire. The door opens and there stands a one-time bourbon-swilling army captain and deft-handed surgeon who now in his later years is a regular at the blackjack tables and the trifectas at Santa Anita. But he is at the heart of it all and perhaps most important, a long-standing, still bitter, and somewhat obsessive expatriate from the 20th century South, the heartbreak Jim Crow land he chose to reject before it could reject him again. He is a Californian now, this Robert Joseph Pershing Foster. He is the color of strong coffee, and he has waves in his hair, which he lets grow as untamed as Einstein's, but then brushes back like the boys in the band. He's wearing a white cotton island shirt, loose slacks and sandals, the uniform of the well-to-do LA pensioner. He has the build and bearing of a Sammy Davis Jr., and not a little of the showmanship and delightful superficiality that seem to grow on people in certain circles of LA. I thought you would like that being here in Oakland. But believe it or not, even in LA, people laughed at that. They know it. They know it. You don't have to tell them. He walked straight back and slew-footed into the foyer, past the curved faux gone with the wind staircase and the East Asian pottery. He gestures toward the living room, an imposing museum of a space that dwarfs him in its volume, fairly frozen in the seafoam carpet and hot pink tulip chairs of a sherbety Doris Day movie from the 50s. The whole effect is as starched and formal as the tuxedos he used to wear to the parties he threw for himself back when his wife Alice was alive and the money was raining down like confetti. He seems accustomed to people fawning over the place, and with the prim air of leading men of his favorite movies from back in the 40s, insists on serving his guests a slice of lemon pound cake and vanilla ice cream on Rosenthal china, whether they would like to have it or not, which I did not because I had just eaten. But he watched as I ate every bite. His heavy-lidded eyes look straight into those of his listener and have a distractingly thick fringe of lashes like those seen on babies and starlets. He is a physician, or was for most of his adult life, and by most accounts, a very good one, and is prone to pontificate like a man of his years and accomplishments. But he is just as likely to interrupt himself and check the time to see if he can still make the 1 o'clock at the Hollywood Park racetrack. His photo albums are filled with an unlikely assortment of bookies and blues singers and dentists and fraternity men and surgeons and society people whose approval he craved, even though he knew they were too pretentious to matter, really. He doesn't say it because it would be gauche and hardly worth mentioning from his point of view, but there happen to be a lot of little Roberts around town, not for the reason you think, but due to the fact that over the years, he delivered a number of baby boys whose mothers were so grateful for his firm hand and calming reassurances at the precise moment of truth that they named their sons not after their husbands, but after the doctor who had delivered their babies. Before he begins to tell his story, he tells you it's a long one and you can't get it all. He's lived too many lives, done too much, known too many people, ridden so high and so low that there's no point in fooling yourself into thinking you can capture the whole of it. You could try, of course, and he agrees to give as much as he can. I love to talk, he says, a smile forming on a still chiseled face as he sits upright in his tulip chair, and I am my favorite subject. I want to conclude this so that we can have time for questions by talking about some of the things that the legacies of this great migration. There is no way to sum up and, you know, 15 years of work, and even if I had all day with you, because it took obviously way longer to write it. But I want to leave you with a reminder of the embodiment of this migration. Almost any immigration experience is judged by, in some ways, what happens to the people once they get there, and what ultimately happens to the children for whom many people are immigrating anyway. Because if you think about any immigration experience, the people who actually are the first to arrive, it's almost too late for them to truly take advantage of all the things that this new world has to offer. For example, if you're coming from another country where you speak a different language, it's very difficult to begin to really truly to learn the language as a native if you're already 30 years old. But the children will get to do that. And the children will be bilingual, or they, in many cases, the parents might not want them to even speak the language of the home country. But in any case, it's often too late for them to really catch up in that way. When it comes to education, for the people of the Great Migration, it was really going to be too late for them to ever make up for the fact that they had gone to segregated schools in the Jim Crow South, where the newspapers openly indicated and said that they were not paying the teachers or providing the same amount of money for the people, for the black students, as they were for the white. In many of these states in the South, and Dr. Foster's parents among them, in the state of Louisiana, for example, the state openly paid the black teachers 45% of what the white teachers were making. They made no apology for that. I mean, how are you going to even begin to replicate any kind of equal system if you're by definition starting out by giving them fewer resources? So there was no pretense that this was equal. And so the people who were part of this migration, there was no way they were going to be able to make up for what they had experienced when it came to school. Dr. Foster went to Monroe Colored High. My mother went to a segregated school. And so often the migration in any immigrant experience is about the next generation, ultimately about the next generation. And so one of the great legacies of this is that the children of these people were, by definition, no matter what they did with the education, were going to be able to get a better education than their parents would have had by definition. What a gift that is for any person who's going to make that great trek. They were going to assure that their children would have a better chance than they did. I'll give you a little example from my own family. My mother went to great trouble to make sure that I could go to an integrated school in Washington, D.C. She actually made arrangements for a cab to pick me up from the time of kindergarten to a school west of the park in Washington. It's divided, it's a very segregated city, it's divided by the park, and she made sure that there was a cab to take me to the school. It was a very prestigious public school, but it was a school where lots of diplomats' children and senators' children went, and she wanted me to go to the school. She would never have had the opportunity to do that, and she would tell the cab driver, "Now don't pick anybody up, only take her. Do not pick anyone else up." Now, that she had to tell him that because a five-year-old cannot be seen from the window of a cab. And so she had to make sure that she told him that. And she would always get the name of the cab number, the name of the cab company and their number in order to make sure of it. And as far as I know, the cab drivers never did break her rule. But just by leaving, they were going to assure that. And I want to give a little sense of some of the things that would not exist in American culture were there no great migration. One is Motown simply wouldn't have existed, simply would not have existed. Why would it not have existed? Berry Gordy, who was the founder of Motown, his parents were born and raised in Georgia. When they married, they decided to migrate to Detroit. They raised their son in Detroit. When he got to be a grown man, he decided he wanted to go into the music industry, fledgling company, nobody had heard of it. Where did he get his talent from? Because he didn't have the funds to be going all over the country as a talent scout. He got them from right in the neighborhood where he was growing up. And all of those people that you listen to in Motown, they are all the children of the Great Migration. In fact, many of them might not have existed had there been no Great Migration. Diana Ross's parents, for example, her mother migrated from Alabama grandma and her father from West Virginia. They met in Detroit, and here you have it. The same with the others in the Supremes. Aretha Franklin, her parents had come up from the South as well. The Jackson Five, the mother came from Alabama, the father from Arkansas. They met up in the North outside of Chicago, settled in Gary, and you have all these things that would never have existed. All of those people were related to the Motown sound, which would not have existed had there been no Great Migration. Jazz, it's hard to even imagine what might have happened had there been no Great Migration. Miles Davis, his parents migrated from Arkansas to Illinois. Had they stayed in Arkansas, it would have been in incomprehensible luxury. What a self-indulgence to be practicing for hours upon hours upon hours when there is work to be done in cotton country of Arkansas. It's a luxury that Southerners would not have had under the Jim Crow system. But he had that opportunity because his parents moved him to Illinois. Thelonious Monk, his parents migrated from North Carolina to Harlem when he was 5 years old. Again, he also had the luxury, the self-indulgent privilege of being able to study music and to take the time, the hours upon hours upon hours that it takes in order to be proficient and to build out the genius that was within him. And John Coltrane. John Coltrane migrated from North Carolina to Philadelphia at 17, where, believe it or not, he got his first alto sax. Where would jazz be if this man had not gone to Philadelphia and gotten his first alto sax? It's incomprehensible. And there are people in his, there must be some people still alive who would probably deny this to this day, but the record shows that he practiced so much, because he actually had a full-time job, he practiced so much that in his apartment building, the tenants there began to protest and say, go to the landlord and say, there's this man and he's practicing the sax at all hours of the day and we have to go to work. Can you make him stop? And can you imagine anybody, you know, what would we do to hear him be able just to play now? They would have to have denied that, I'm sure, if they were with us today. But in any case, a minister gave him the keys to a church where he could practice to his heart's content, and therefore we have jazz. And I want to finish with Bill Russell, a son of Oakland. And it brings us back to Monroe. His parents had a really, really unbelievably difficult time in Monroe, Louisiana. We all know who Bill Russell was, Bill Russell, or is. He was one of the greatest basketball players of all time. It's frightening to think what would have happened had his parents not migrated from Monroe, Louisiana. But they did, because they were having such a hard time in Monroe. One day, Bill Russell's father needed to get gas. He went to a gas station in Monroe, where what the custom was in most of the South, and he knew what the custom was, and he was having some difficulty abiding by it, because the custom was that any place that a black person would go for service, to buy something, whether it was an ice cream cone or whether it was gas, was that they had to wait for any white person who was ahead of them. And if any white person should walk in while they were still there, they had to let that person go ahead of them. That meant that a black person could be waiting for a very long time if white people continued to come into the ice cream store, for example. In this case, he needed to get gas. And he waited and he waited and he waited, and there continued to come white motorists to get their gas. At a certain point, he was in a hurry, and so he would back out. He had to think about what he was going to do, because this is Monroe, Louisiana, so he might have to drive another half an hour to the next gas station, but it was not looking like it was going to get any better anytime soon at that particular gas station. So he began to back out of the gas station, trying not to call too much attention to himself, because people had to be very careful how they comported themselves if they were black in the South. The owner of the gas station saw him trying to back out. He stopped pumping the gas for the white motorist at that moment. And the owner of the gas station went over to Bill Russell's father, put a gun to his head, and said, "You will leave here when I say you can leave." So he wouldn't let him leave. Around the same time, Bill Russell's mother was walking down in downtown Monroe in a very nice dress that she saved up a long time for. Sheriff's deputy saw her in this dress and thought it was too nice for a black woman of that day to be wearing. And so he told her, he went up to her and he said, "Don't ever go out on that in that dress again. Go home right now and take it off or I will arrest you. That dress that you have on, what you have on now, is not for a colored woman to wear. That is only for white women to wear." Bill Russell, who was about 8 or 9 years old, saw his mother crying at the kitchen table because they were trying to figure out what they were going to do. What were the options? To continue to stay under those circumstances or to leave and set out for a place far away? The migration route out of Monroe would take you either to Detroit or to Oakland primarily. And so they set out on a course for Oakland, where Bill Russell had the opportunity to go to integrated schools, where he had the opportunity to go to an NCAA college. He would never have had the opportunity to go to an NCAA college and play NCAA basketball had he been in Louisiana, Monroe, Louisiana, in the late 40s and early 1950s. It would have been incomprehensible because the schools were not integrated at that time. And so he had the opportunity to lead the Dons to two NCAA championships right here in the Bay Area. And then he was recruited to the Celtics, where he led the Celtics to 11 championships in 13 seasons. Where would basketball be if it were not for the fact that these people, his parents, migrated from Monroe, Louisiana? In some ways, you might say that basketball owes a great debt to the Great Migration. Oakland owes a great debt to the Great Migration. We all owe a great debt to the Great Migration. And these are only some of the examples. I have many, many, many examples of the many people, Toni Morrison, Ralph Ellison, August Wilson. There are so many examples. That go, Oprah Winfrey goes on and on and on. And many of the people in this room, many of the people right here, and many of the people that, if you're not a part of the Great Migration, people that you know. It's a phenomenal and beautiful thing. And I want to close with the epigraph of the book, where the title of the book comes from, The Warmth of Other Suns. What were they seeking? They were seeking the warmth of other suns. And how ironic that is, because the sun in the south is warmer than the sun in the north. But that just shows you how determined and desperate they were to get out. Anything was warmer than the sun of the sun that they were under. And so this is what Richard Wright wrote. And I found this in a passage from his autobiography. This book was an orphan, nameless child for much of the time I was working on it, which was another reason why people didn't believe it existed. But I finally found the name when I found this passage, and I want to read it to you and close with this. "I was leaving the South to fling myself into the unknown. I was taking a part of the South to transplant in alien soil, to see if it could grow differently, if it could drink of new and cool rains, bend in strange winds, respond to the warmth of other suns, and perhaps to bloom." I'd like to close with my interpretation in some ways of what that means for us today. Because there's now what many people will refer to as a reverse migration. I consider that a continuation of the migration that we that I've written about. And to me, what it means is that, first of all, that passage refers to almost anyone who's at any point in their life where they would like to make a change, need to make a change, and need the courage in order to make that change. That means people of all ethnicities and backgrounds. It also means that we have so much more in common than we've been led to believe, which is what I hope people take away from this book, that anyone can see themselves in the lives and the hearts and the dreams and the wishes of Ida Mae Gladney, George Swanson Starling, and Robert Joseph Pershing Foster. And finally, ultimately, there are no other suns. Why are there no other suns? It's because ultimately the message of all of this, for all of the three of them really, is that the sun was in each of them. The sun is what propelled them to take this great risk. The sun is us. And to me, that's the greatest lesson of all, because these are individual people who were not listening to leaders. They listened to their own hearts, and they did what their hearts told them to do. And that's a lesson for all of them. If they could do what they did with the little that they had, imagine what the rest of us could do. So thank you so much for coming, and I'm so happy to take your questions.